Psalms are not interesting, I remarked.
That proves you have a wicked heart, and you must pray to God to change it, to give you a new and clean one, to take away your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh.
I was about to propound a question, touching the manner in which that operation of changing my heart was to be performed, when Mrs. Reed interposed, telling me to sit down. She then proceeded to carry on the conversation herself.
"Mr. Brocklehurst, I believe I intimated in the letter which I wrote to you 3 weeks ago that this little girl has not quite the character and disposition I could wish. Should you admit her into Lowood School, I should be glad if the superintendent and teachers were requested to keep a strict eye on her, and above all, to guard against her worst fault, a tendency to deceit." I mention this in your hearing, Jane, that you may not attempt to impose on Mr. Brocklehurst.
Well might I dread, well might I dislike Mrs. Reed, for it was her nature to wound me cruelly. Never was I happy in her presence, however carefully I obeyed, however strenuously I strove to please her. My efforts were still repulsed and repaid by such sentences as the above. Now, uttered before a stranger, the accusation cut me to the heart. I dimly perceived that she was already obliterating hope from the new phase of existence which she destined me to enter. I felt, though I could not have expressed the feeling, that she was sowing aversion and unkindness along my future path. I saw myself transformed under Mr. Brocklehurst's eye into an artful, noxious child. And what could I do to remedy the injury? Nothing indeed, thought I, as I struggled to repress a sob, and hastily wiped away some tears, the impotent evidences of my anguish.
Deceit is indeed a sad fault in a child, said Mr. Brocklehurst. It is akin to falsehood, and all liars will have their portion in the lake burning with fire and brimstone. She shall, however, be watched, Mrs. Reed. I will speak to Miss Temple and the teachers.
I should wish her to be brought up in a manner suiting her prospects, continued my benefactress, to be made useful, to be kept humble. As for the vacations, she will, with your permission, spend them always at Lowood.
Your decisions are perfectly judicious, madam, returned Mr. Brocklehurst. Humility is a Christian grace, and one peculiarly appropriate to the pupils of Lowood. I therefore direct that especial care shall be bestowed on its cultivation amongst them. I have studied how best to mortify in them the worldly sentiment of pride, and only the other day I had a pleasing proof of my success. My second daughter, Augusta, went with her mamma to visit the school, and on her return she exclaimed, "Oh, dear papa, how quiet and plain all the girls at Lowood look, with their hair combed behind their ears, and their long pinafores and those little holland pockets outside their frocks. They are almost like poor people's children." "And," said she, "they looked at my dress and mamma's as if they had never seen a silk gown before."
"This is the state of things I quite approve," returned Mrs. Reed. "Had I sought all England over, I could scarcely have found a system more exactly fitting a child like Jane Eyre. Consistency, my dear Mr. Brocklehurst, I advocate consistency in all things."
"Consistency, madam, is the first of Christian duties, and it has been observed in every arrangement connected with the establishment of Lowood. Plain fare, simple attire, unsophisticated accommodations, hardy and active habits. Such is the order of the day in the house and its inhabitants."
"Quite right, sir. I may then depend upon this child being received as a pupil at Lowood, and there being trained in conformity to her position and prospects?"
"Madam, you may. She shall be placed in that nursery of chosen plants, and I trust she will show herself grateful for the inestimable privilege of her election."
I will send her then as soon as possible, Mr. Brocklehurst, for I assure you I feel anxious to be relieved of a responsibility that was becoming too irksome.
No doubt, no doubt, madam, and now I wish you good morning. I shall return to Brocklehurst Hall in the course of a week or two. My good friend, the Archdeacon, will not permit me to leave him sooner. I shall send Miss Temple notice that she is to expect a new girl, so that there will be no difficulty about receiving her. Goodbye.
Goodbye, Mr. Brocklehurst. Remember me to Mrs. and Miss Brocklehurst, and to Augusta and Theodore, and Master Broughton Brocklehurst.
I will, madam, little girl. Here is a book entitled The Child's Guide. Read it with prayer, especially the part containing an account of the awfully sudden death of Martha G., a naughty child addicted to falsehood and deceit.
With these words, Mr. Brocklehurst put into my hand a thin pamphlet sewn in a cover, and having rung for his carriage, he departed. Mrs. Reed and I were left alone. Some minutes passed in silence. She was sewing. I was watching her. Mrs. Reed might be at that time some 6 or 7 and 30. She was a woman of robust frame, square-shouldered and strong-limbed, not tall, and though stout, not obese. She had a somewhat large face, the underjaw being much developed and very solid. Her brow was low, her chin large and prominent, mouth and nose sufficiently regular. Under her light eyebrows glimmered an eye devoid of ruth. Her skin was dark and opaque, her hair nearly flaxen. Her constitution was sound as a bell. Illness never came near her. She was an exact, clever manager. Her household and tenantry were thoroughly under her control. Her children only at times defied her authority and laughed it to scorn. She dressed well, and had a presence and port calculated to set off handsome attire. Sitting on a low stool, a few yards from her armchair, I examined her figure. I perused her features. In my hand, I held the tract containing the sudden death of the liar, to which narrative my attention had been pointed as an appropriate warning. What had just passed, what Mrs. Reed had said concerning me to Mr. Brocklehurst, the whole tenor of their conversation, was recent, raw and stinging in my mind. I had felt every word as acutely as I had heard it plainly, and a passion of resentment fomented now within me. Mrs. Reed looked up from her work. Her eyes settled on mine, her fingers at the same time suspended their nimble movements. "Go out of the room, return to the nursery," was her mandate. My look, or something else, must have struck her as offensive, for she spoke with extreme, though suppressed, irritation. I got up. I went to the door. I came back again. I walked to the window across the room, then close up to her. Speak, I must. I had been trodden on severely, and must turn. But how? What strength had I to dart retaliation at my antagonist? I gathered my energies and launched them in this blunt sentence. "I am not deceitful. If I were, I should say I loved you. But I declare I do not love you. I dislike you the worst of anybody in the world except John Reed. And this book about the liar you may give to your girl, Georgiana, for it is she who tells lies and not I." Mrs. Reed's hands still lay on her work, inactive. Her eye of ice continued to dwell freezingly on mine. "What more have you to say?" she asked, rather in the tone in which a person might address an opponent of adult age than such as is ordinarily used to a child. That eye of hers, that voice, stirred every antipathy I had. Shaking from head to foot, thrilled with ungovernable excitement, I continued, "'I am glad you are no relation of mine. "'I will never call you aunt again. "'As long as I live, "'I will never come to see you when I am grown up, "'and if anyone asks me how I liked you "'and how you treated me, "'I will say the very thought of you makes me sick, "'and that you treated me with miserable cruelty. "'How dare you affirm that, Jane Eyre? "'How dare I, Mrs. Reed? "'How dare I? "'Because it is the truth. "'You think I have no feelings, "'and that I can do without one bit of love or kindness, "'but I cannot live so, and you have no pity. "'I shall remember how you thrust me back, "'roughly and violently thrust me back into the Red Room, "'and locked me up there to my dying day. "'Though I was in agony, though I cried out while suffocating with distress, have mercy, Aunt Reed!' "'And that punishment you made me suffer because your wicked boy struck me, "'knocked me down for nothing. "'I will tell anybody who asks me questions this exact tale. "'People think you are a good woman, but you are bad, hard-hearted. "'You are deceitful!' "'Ere I had finished this reply, my soul began to expand, to exult, with the strangest sense of freedom, of triumph I ever felt. It seemed as if an invisible bond had burst, and that I had struggled out into unhoped-for liberty. Not without cause was this sentiment. Mrs. Reed looked frightened. Her work had slipped from her knee. She was lifting up her hands, rocking herself to and fro, and even twisting her face as if she would cry. "'Jane, you are under a mistake. What is the matter with you? Why do you tremble so violently? Would you like to drink some water?'
"'No, Mrs. Reed.
Is there anything else you wish for, Jane? I assure you, I desire to be your friend.'
"'Not you. You told Mr. Brocklehurst I had a bad character, a deceitful disposition, and I'll let everybody at Lowood know what you are and what you have done.
Jane, you don't understand these things. Children must be corrected for their faults.
Deceit is not my fault,
I cried out in a savage, high voice.
But you are passionate, Jane, that you must allow. And now return to the nursery, there's a dear, and lie down a little.
I am not your dear. I cannot lie down. Send me to school soon, Mrs. Reed, for I hate to live here. I will indeed send her to school soon, murmured Mrs. Reed sotto voce, and gathering up her work, she abruptly quitted the apartment. I was left there alone. Winner of the field. It was the hardest battle I had fought, and the first victory I had gained. I stood a while on the rug where Mr. Brocklehurst had stood, and I enjoyed my conqueror's solitude. First I smiled to myself and felt elate, but this fierce pleasure subsided in me as fast as did the accelerated throb of my pulses. A child cannot quarrel with its elders, as I had done, cannot give its furious feelings uncontrolled play, as I had given mine, without experiencing afterwards the pang of remorse and the chill of reaction. A ridge of lighted heath, alive, glancing, devouring, would have been a meet emblem of my mind when I accused and menaced Mrs. Reed. The same ridge, black and blasted after the flames are dead, would have represented as meetly my subsequent condition, when half an hour's silence and reflection had shown me the madness of my conduct and the dreariness of my hated and hating position. Something of vengeance I had tasted for the first time, as aromatic wine it seemed, unswallowing, warm and racy, its afterflavour metallic and corroding, gave me a sensation as if I had been poisoned. Willingly would I now have gone and asked Mrs. Reed's pardon, but I knew, partly from experience and partly from instinct, that was the way to make her repulse me with double scorn, thereby re-exciting every turbulent impulse of my nature.
I would fain exercise some better faculty than that of fear speaking, fain find nourishment for some less fiendish feeling than that of sombre indignation. I took a book, some Arabian tales. I sat down and endeavored to read. I could make no sense of the subject. My own thoughts swam always between me and the page I had usually found fascinating. I opened the glass door in the breakfast room. The shrubbery was quite still. The black frost reigned, unbroken by sun or breeze through the grounds. I covered my head in arms with the skirt of my frock, and went out to walk in a part of the plantation which was quite sequestrated. But I found no pleasure in the silent trees, the falling fir cones, the congealed relics of autumn, russet leaves, swept by past winds in heaps, and now stiffened together. I leaned against a gate and looked into an empty field where no sheep were feeding, where the short grass was nipped and blanched. It was a very grey day, a most opaque sky, onding on snaw, canopied all. Thence flakes felt at intervals, which settled on the hard path and on the hoary lea, without melting. I stood, a wretched child enough, whispering to myself over and over again, "What shall I do? What shall I do?" All at once I heard a clear voice call, "Miss Jane, where are you? Come to lunch." It was Bessie. I knew well enough, but I did not stir. Her light step came tripping down the path. "You naughty little thing," she said. "Why don't you come when you are called?" Bessie's presence, compared with the thoughts over which I had been brooding, seemed cheerful, even though, as usual, she was somewhat cross. The fact is, after my conflict with and victory over Mrs. Reed, I was not disposed to care much for the nursemaid's transitory anger, and I was disposed to bask in her youthful lightness of heart. I just put my two arms round her and said, "Come, Bessie, don't scold." The action was more frank and fearless than any I was habituated to indulge in. Somehow, it pleased her. "You are a strange child, Miss Jane," she said as she looked down at me. "A little roving, solitary thing. And you are going to school, I suppose." I nodded. "And you won't be sorry to leave poor Bessie?" "What does Bessie care for me? She is always scolding me." "Because you are such a queer, frightened, shy little thing. You should be bolder." "What, to get more knocks?" "Nonsense! But you are rather put upon, that's certain. My mother said, when she came to see me last week, that she would not like a little one of her own to be in your place. Now come in, and I've got some good news for you." "I don't think you have, Bessie." "Child, what do you mean? What sorrowful eyes you fix on me! Well, but Mrs. and the young ladies and Master John are going out to tea this afternoon, and you shall have tea with me. I'll ask cook to bake you a little cake, and then you shall help me to look over your drawers, for I am soon to pack your trunk. Mrs. intends you to leave Gateshead in a day or two, and you shall choose what toys you like to take with you. Bessie, you must promise not to scold me any more till I go." "Well, I will. But mind you are a very good girl, and don't be afraid of me. Don't start when I chance to speak rather sharply. It's so provoking." "I don't think I shall ever be afraid of you again, Bessie, because I have got used to you, and I shall soon have another set of people to dread."
"If you dread them, they'll dislike you."
"As you do, Bessie."
"I don't dislike you, miss. I believe I am fonder of you than of all the others."
"You don't show it."
"You little sharp thing! You've got quite a new way of talking. What makes you so venturesome and hardy?"
"Why, I shall soon be away from you. And besides, I was going to say something about what had passed between me and Mrs. Reed, but on second thoughts I considered it better to remain silent on that head."
"And so you're glad to leave me?"
"Not at all, Bessie. Indeed, just now I'm rather sorry."
"Just now, and rather! How coolly my little lady says it! I dare say now if I were to ask you for a kiss, you wouldn't give it me. You'd say you'd rather not."
"I'll kiss you, and welcome.
"Bend your head down." Bessie stooped. We mutually embraced, and I followed her into the house quite comforted. That afternoon lapsed in peace and harmony, and in the evening Bessie told me some of her most enchanting stories and sang me some of her sweetest songs. Even for me, life had its gleams of sunshine.